Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. The Center for Battered Women's Legal Services at Sanctuary for Families in New York City is the largest program of its kind in the country for domestic violence victims. It provides legal representation in family law, civil rights, public benefits, housing, and immigration cases, while also advocating policy and legislative changes to further the rights of victims and gender violence survivors. In 2014, working in partnership with 400 pro bono lawyers, the center provided legal assistance to more than 4,000 men, women, and children. And the woman who has served as the center's director since 1994 is my guest today. Attorney and social activist Dorchen Lightholt has won a hell of a resume. Since the mid-70s, she's been a leader in the movement against violence against women, counseling and advocating for rape victims, organizing against the promotion of violence against women in the media, representing hundreds of victims of domestic violence, prostitution, trafficking, sex assault, female genital mutilation, and the online bride business. In 1988, Dorchen founded the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women and currently sits on the board. She has spoken in this country and others about gender violence issues, testifying before Congress on the economics of human trafficking. She's trained prosecutors in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and local and federal police in Mexico City on gender violence. Dorchen's written numerous articles and co-edited the Lawyer's Manual on Human Trafficking and the fourth and fifth editions of the Lawyer's Manual on Domestic Violence. She's received numerous awards and honors, including the UN Capital Association Human Rights Award, the City of New York Award for Outstanding Leadership in Breaking the Cycle of Domestic Violence, and the New York State Coalition Against Domestic Violence's 30 Years, 30 Leaders Award. Dorchen, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy. It's wonderful to be here.
My first obvious question to you is, were you born a social activist?
Probably. Early on, I was aware of social injustice. I'm from a military family. My father was a career military officer. We lived on military bases in different parts of the country, and I saw a lot of inequality.
How so? And, what did you see on the military bases?
Well, the military is extraordinarily hierarchical. And back then, when I was growing up, I mean, one saw injustices on the issue of race. Mm. You saw very few people of color as officers, no women.
Right.
And so it was a lesson in inequality and in hierarchy. And then I am your generation. Mm-hmm. I'm a baby boomer. And became politically active as a teenager, you know, aware of these issues, but also aware of a growing social justice movement. I identified with the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, and became an activist pretty naturally, although much of my childhood was spent in Virginia. And I was a little bit of a marching to a different drummer, a little bit of a fish out of water.
For a military family?
Well, also in my high school, there were not many students focused on social justice issues. I was one, and there were a few fellow travelers.
Sure.
But it became an increasingly important issue to me. Women's rights became an increasingly important issue to me.
Were you supported by your parents?
Well, my father certainly wouldn't have identified with my interest in the anti-war movement.
Yeah, that's why I asked.
Both of my parents were really pretty supportive. A little bit of resistance on the paternal side. But my mother, I come from a long line of women who really supported and encouraged their daughters. So I was very, very fortunate to have the mother that I have, who is still living at almost 94. She will be very unhappy that I've disclosed her age. But I identified with the women's movement very strongly. And then I had experiences like so many young women that really furthered that identification.
Share some of them with me.
One perhaps pivotal experience happened, and I've just started talking about this for the first time, when I was about 19 years old. And I was studying at the University of Virginia and planning to go to Washington, D.C. with a friend of mine to see an Allman Brothers concert and to see A Raisin in the Sun at the Arena Theater. And we were going to stay with a friend of hers, whom I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then my friend wasn't able to join me, and I went alone. And it was a very, very rough weekend with a lot of sexual harassment and an attempted sexual assault.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And but so that's the experience of so many young women. And I was already politicized. And at that point, I really committed myself to the women's movement and to working on issues of gender-based violence. I wouldn't have used that terminology at that time. And I ended up in graduate school at the University of Virginia and worked as a rape crisis counselor and just was overwhelmed by my inability to really do anything to assist the victims and survivors I was counseling. You know, there was no justice. And there were egregious examples of abuse that women suffered. And just the police, prosecutors were really not helpful at all, although women were mobilizing. And then something happened at the University of Virginia. There's a place, a sort of student corner called The Corner across from Mr. Jefferson's University. And a restaurant opened up for students. It was sort of a pub, and it was called the Minories, named after the district that Jack the Ripper prowled. And it was really, in many ways, a monument to the Ripper. And the entrees on the menu were named after the women, the prostituted women that he eviscerated
and
murdered.
Are you serious?
It was. And so I, with my burgeoning consciousness.
What's in a name, Dorjan?
And my work with victims, my own experience, and just the University of Virginia, there is a lot of, I'm sure there continues to be, but at that time there was a tremendous amount of misogyny and violence on campus that was tolerated by university officials. I think that really radicalized me. So I helped organize a protest of the Minories. Ultimately, we were successful
in shutting it down.
Mm-hmm. And that was a different experience. I realized that through organizing, we could have an impact. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, the students that mobilized to shut that down, it wasn't only the feminists on campus. It was also gay rights activists, civil rights activists. I guess at a school like that that was pretty conservative, the progressive students came together. And so that was really a very positive experience.
And obviously a seminal moment for you.
I think definitely. And then I came to New York, and I think the reasons I came to New York is I knew that there was a great deal of important work happening here on issues of gender-based violence. There was an organization called New York Radical Feminists that had held the first Speak Out on Rape, the first Speak Out on Prostitution. They were really looking at women's condition deeply and thoughtfully and from a gender-aware lens and making all kinds of connections. And so it was a great place to be. I came here a little late. I came here in 1977, and New York Radical Feminists was disbanding at that time. But I was the beneficiary of their brilliant theorizing and their work. Mm-hmm. And I worked with a group initially when I arrived called Women Against Violence Against Women, mm-hmm. another group called New York Women Against Rape, and I was very active in its sort of public education wing.
And were you also involved with Women Against
Women Against Pornography. And, mm-hmm. and really just doing a lot of learning and a lot of activism. And I had the privilege of working with feminist leaders like Gloria Steinem and Robin Morgan, Susan Brownmiller, Andrea Dworkin, mm-hmm. Catherine McKinnon. Mm-hmm. So I was very fortunate, a generation younger than those feminists.
Were you a lawyer then?
No. And, you know, I was working as an editor, and I say I was an editor by day and an activist by night and over the weekends. And that's just the way it was back then. It never occurred to me that this would be a career for me, that I would ever be compensated for this work. It was work I did out of a strong sense of mission. But at some point, I realized that having a law degree would be valuable, that I could be more effective as a leader, as an activist with a law degree. So that had never occurred to me before. I remember the moment I had this epiphany, and it's a little bit irrational, but something really horrific was happening at that time. And there was a young woman, the first African-American woman to be crowned Miss America. Her name was Vanessa Williams,
Hello. Yeah.
And at that time, there had been a photographer who had taken explicit photographs of her and was publishing them.
I remember this.
And so the Miss America organizers divested her of her crown.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time that Penthouse magazine published those photographs of her. And I was just enraged. I was enraged at the pageant officials. I was enraged at Bob Guccione and Penthouse.
Mm-hmm.
To see this, certainly wasn't a fan of the Miss America contest,
of course. Right.
But understood that here was an African-American woman who was really breaking through obstacles. And at that point, I thought, if I had a law degree,
I'd have some power.
Maybe I could do something mm-hmm. to help women mm-hmm. like Vanessa Williams and others. And really, I don't know what I would have done now. I sort of laugh when I think about it, but I'm not sure I could be effective in a situation like that with a law degree. But it's what prompted me to go to law school, and I applied to various law schools. I was shocked to get into NYU, shocked to get a close to full scholarship. And I found that having that law degree, it actually was what I hoped it would be. It is a very, very useful tool to have, and I've used it ever since.
If you're just joining me, my guest today is Dortchen Leithold, who is a social activist and attorney. There was something that you said before that I want to pick up mm-hmm. on about being a rape counselor mm-hmm. at UVA mm-hmm. back in the 70s. And yeah. look what's going on today
yes.
with women on college campuses feeling powerless. Does that on some level just make you nuts that all these years later there's not that much of a difference?
Well, I'm actually heartened by what's happening because I see, you know, at this point in my career, I'm thinking succession and I'm thinking, where are the next wave mm-hmm. of feminist activists? And what I'm seeing on college campuses is so impressive to me. I mean, I'm seeing brilliant, strategic young women and men speaking out, often at great personal risk, and having an impact. You know, Governor Cuomo has proposed legislation that would strengthen college and university responses to sexual assault. I mean, that's the result of those activists. So I'm very heartened by what I'm seeing.
So it's not we're still dealing with this.
Is well, you know, gender inequality and gender-based violence has very, very deep roots and goes to the core of our society. And really, women didn't take it on, and now women and men in an organized, focused way until the late 70s. And that's really
recent,
a very short period mm-hmm. of time historically. Mm-hmm. You know, interestingly enough, the suffragists were also focused on gender-based violence. And that's something that often isn't understood. One of the reasons they so desperately wanted women to have the vote is so that women could affect legal reforms that would enable abuse victims to divorce abusive husbands. So it's not entirely a new issue, but we haven't seen a mass movement, social change movement focus on violence against women until the late 70s. So I think we're making a lot of progress, but we also still have a very long way to go.
So talk to me about the Center for Battered Women's Legal Services Sanctuary. First of all, that's your main occupation.
Well, I mean,
it sounds like you got your fingers in 5,000 different pies.
You know, really see myself as leader in the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And while Sanctuary for Families. I love Sanctuary for Families. I think it's a wonderful and effective organization. That's part of my work, a big part of my work. I came to the Center for Battered Women's Legal Services in 1994, so I've been there for just over 20 years.
That's a long time.
And I came to my dream job in many respects. I came to the reason that I went to law school because it enabled me to work on issues of violence against women and girls, gender violence, in a very focused and intensive way. Sanctuary for Families is an amazing organization. Not only is there a strong legal services, legal advocacy wing, but we provide shelter every night to more than 200 victims and their children. We provide trauma-informed counseling. We provide economic empowerment, you know, help victims get the tools they need to become economically independent so they don't have to depend on an abuser.
Of course.
And can really obtain living wage jobs and provide a quality of life for their children that they weren't able to previously. Most of our clients are women, the vast, vast majority.
But there are men, aren't there?
There are men. I mean, mostly through our LGBT initiative.
Uh-huh.
And those men who are victims of violence have experiences very similar to our female clients. The forms of physical abuse, the sexual abuse, the psychological abuse, all those gender-based epithets that are used against women are used against them by mm-hmm. by abusive partners. So, and when I came to the Center for Battered Women's Legal Services, I was the director of one other lawyer and a wonderful paralegal, Evelyn Sepulveda, who is still with us. And, you know, I came at a very propitious time. So again, I've often felt that I'm walking in big footprints. I came to New York City and there was so much amazing feminist work that was happening that I was the beneficiary of, as I mentioned. And I felt the same way when I came to Sanctuary for Families. I felt that I had this amazing project that I could grow. And what a great time it was to grow the legal center at Sanctuary, because the Federal Violence Against Women Act passed that year.
And in 94?
In 1994, and all of a sudden funding was directed to programs like the one I was running. There were new remedies available for abuse victims. I mean, one very important remedy was it enabled immigrant victims of domestic violence married to U.S. citizens or permanent residents who were dependent on their abusers for immigration sponsorship to self-petition. You know, we've been able to assist, I would say at this point, thousands of immigrant women get on the path to permanent residence status to citizenship. That became available that year, 1994. New York State passed sweeping legislative reform that very year called the Family Protection Domestic Violence Intervention Act that had a mandatory arrest provision. You know, police officers would come to a home after a 911 call and find a bleeding, bruised woman and pretty much respond by sending her husband out to the street to cool off.
And
not,
calm down.
Not making an arrest. Mm-hmm. So a complete failure to protect. That changed in 1994. New York State adopted a mandatory arrest law and just began to see the criminal justice system change. It still has a long way to go, but it was a great time to start doing this work and to begin to think about what are the most urgent needs of victims. How can we address them? And we grew. We're now 35 attorneys strong. So on an individual level, we're having an enormous impact. And for me, that's really the heart of the work, what we can do for individual women, helping them get safe, helping them become empowered, often helping them become leaders. But we're also able to engage in what we call systems change advocacy, changing systems to make them more responsive to the needs of victims and having quite an impact. We've had victory after victory on the legislative front, on the impact litigation front. We had a strong effort that resulted in New York State having a law against stalking. Didn't exist previously. We helped draft legislation against choking or strangulation. Previously, police officers would come to a home after a domestic violence call, and the victim had been choked, but they wouldn't see visible signs of injury.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wouldn't respond. And actually, strangulation, choking, is a lethality indicator. And so police were coming to the scene of a potential homicide and not recognizing it as such. We were able to change that law. Victims in non-traditional families weren't able to access family court for orders of protection.
What's a non-traditional family?
People who were living together but mm-hmm. didn't have a child in common, LGBT families, mm-hmm. especially before marriage equality. And we were able to open the doors of family court to those families with new reforms in 2008. And most recently, we have passed very strong laws against human trafficking in New York State.
I want to talk about that, too. Let's sort of segue over to the fact that you started this coalition against trafficking in women and you're currently on the board.
Yes.
So what's the genesis of that? How did you two come together?
While I was working on issues of sexual violence, I met a young woman, and she was a working-class young woman who was working in the garment district. Her husband at the time was a subway conductor, and she was trying to have a baby, and she wasn't able to succeed in getting pregnant. And then I began to learn why. When she was 14 years old, she ran away from home because she was being sexually abused by her stepfather, and she fell under the control of a brutal gang of pimps who gang raped her, who seasoned her into prostitution.
Here in New York?
Here in New York, and then trafficked her all over the country. And she was a child. She was a teenager. She became a heroin addict. And actually, her heroin addiction probably saved her life, ironically, because she became emaciated. You know, she was no longer a marketable commodity.
Right.
She ended up in a drug rehabilitation program on the West Coast. And then she made her way back to her family in New York and began to work on rebuilding her life. And she was breathtakingly brilliant. And she was my teacher about trafficking. I learned about trafficking from her experiences. I learned about its prevalence. I learned about how pimps operate. I learned about the role of the buyers.
Let me interrupt and ask, what's the difference between trafficking, for example, and prostitution?
Well, there's a
lot. Wasn't she basically, you know, pimped out and she was a prostitute?
She was prostituted and she was trafficked. And that's a really, really good question. And there are many different definitions of trafficking, but there is an enormous overlap between trafficking and prostitution. I mean, we know that most people enter prostitution as she did as teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And prostituted kids are trafficking victims under our federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act. So if you're a minor and you're prostituted, somebody's prostituting you, you're being trafficked. A pimp is a trafficker. So under our federal law, it's a little bit complicated because there are a bunch of different definitions. But in my view, I actually would turn to the international definition that the United Nations embraces. And if there's been an abuse of power or a position of vulnerability to induce someone into prostitution, it's trafficking. So the reality is, most prostitution is trafficking. Are there instances where someone is a volunteer and makes an affirmative choice to enter prostitution? Of course.
But you certainly aren't volunteering to be trafficked.
But those are rare.
Right.
Rare. Most people who enter prostitution enter because there's someone else exploiting them, sometimes promising them a job that doesn't really exist, or getting control over a vulnerable child or a young person who very likely has a pre-existing history of trauma. So the overlap between trafficking and prostitution is quite profound. Not everyone wants to recognize that, but it is the reality. So she was a trafficking victim under federal law. I mean, she was beaten and brutalized by the pimps. She had scars on her legs from beatings with coat hangers. She had teeth that pimps had knocked out during beatings. I mean, there was our federal criminal law defines trafficking in terms of force, fraud, or coercion. And that was writ large in her case. She was an extraordinary teacher, and she became a leader. She went on to found a group of survivors of trafficking and prostitution called WHISPR, that stands for Women Hurt in Systems of Prostitution Engaged in Revolt. So for me, it was, again, another epiphany. I guess you'd say I learned so much from her, and I went on with her to organize a conference here in New York City in 1998, and we reached out to leaders and activists all over the world. And there was amazing work in this area at that time happening in Asia. There was a Japanese feminist leader, Yayoi Matsui, who had organized Asian women in multiple countries to address the phenomenon of Japanese male sex tourists going to the poorest countries in Asia to buy the bodies of women and girls there.
And bring them back to Japan?
And well, they would go. No, they would go on sex tour junkets to those countries.
Oh, silly me.
And their corporations would cover the cost of their trips. And this was a perk for being a successful businessman in Japan. And Yayoi, such an amazing leader who's no longer living, organized feminists in the Philippines and in Thailand to greet these businessmen when they arrived with picket signs and chants and really exposed them and stopped that. So she joined us at our conference, an amazing leader for the Philippines named Aurora Havate de Dios, who had been an activist against Marcos and then part of a little group of I would say, radical feminist think tank in the Philippines called Kalayaan began to think about what was happening in the Philippines to women. And essentially, the experience of women in the Philippines was a colonial experience with Spain, the United States, and Japan, and a huge prostitution, military prostitution, sex tourism industry that they were thinking about and becoming activists against. They joined us at that conference, and so many others, an amazing nun from Peru working with rural sex trafficking survivors. And so it was, again, another, for me, an experience of learning and the beginning,
that translated into doing
the beginning of the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women that is very, very powerful today on the international front with amazing leadership. Our executive director is Taina Biena May, a formidable leader, taking on right now. It's focused on Abe, Japan's prime minister, denying the sexual enslavement of women throughout Southeast Asia during World War II, the so-called comfort women. I don't know if you're following. The Japanese government asked textbooks to take reference to the comfort women's ordeal of sexual slavery, to take it out of the textbooks. And so the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women is spearheading a campaign to really force Japanese leadership to acknowledge this atrocity and to apologize for it, really, really following the lead of Yayoi Matsui, who is no longer with us. So great, great work. But those are the origins of my work on trafficking.
But today, in 2015, what are you working on?
I would say that we have really made a lot of progress on the domestic violence front, and we're seeing statistics reflect that progress. For example, we're seeing a significant decrease in domestic violence homicide, and I attribute
countrywide.
And I attribute it very much to the great work of activists, the fact that there are shelters for victims to go to, that law enforcement is more responsive to domestic violence than ever before. Many, many changes that just public awareness, bystander intervention campaigns, men are speaking out. You know, on the issue of trafficking and prostitution, I think we're sort of where we were 30 years ago with domestic violence, and we have a lot of work to do. We have a situation now where a person in prostitution who is likely to be a trafficking victim is far more likely to be arrested by the police than the trafficker or pimp or the patronizer who is providing the economic incentive to this lucrative industry. We have a lot of work to do on the criminal justice front, but we've achieved major, major legislative gains. I helped spearhead an organization in New York State called the New York State Anti-Trafficking Coalition in 2004 that is responsible for the fact that we have strong felony-level laws against trafficking in New York State. More recently, we passed an omnibus bill that the New York State legislature unanimously passed an omnibus bill called the Trafficking Victims Protection and Justice Act that really focuses on some areas that where we really needed to have legislative fixes.
What just dawned on me is that you'll never not have a job.
You know, I'm seeing so many changes. I do think that we're making progress, and there is so much more public awareness. And one very exciting development is we're seeing there are unlikely allies who are joining this effort. I mean, a lot of faith-based folks joining this effort. Men are increasingly becoming allies to women working on these issues. I think men are recognizing that they're harmed by systems of violence, mm-hmm. institutions of violence as well. So I'm very hopeful, and I think we as activists and leaders are doing it differently.
Clearly, you've got a lot to say because you've done so much, and there's more to do, and the world needs more Dorchen Lightholds. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy. It's such a pleasure to be here, and thank you for your great work.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.